Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Robert Robertson is scheduled to die tomorrow. He is set to be executed by the state of Texas for a crime that experts say did not happen. There is overwhelming evidence that points that Robertson's 2-year-old daughter, Nikki, did not die from physical abuse. Instead, she died from her chronic health conditions and pneumonia. Nevertheless, the Texas courts have been unwilling to hear this evidence. This morning, the Texas Legislative Committee on Jurisprudence held a special hearing on Robertson's case and on the mismanagement of the death penalty in Texas. This is what the chair, Representative Joe Moody, said at the start of the hearing, calling attention to how important it is for lawmakers to get the death penalty right, which right now doesn't seem to be the case.
If the legislature cannot exercise oversight over a potential breach of a duly enacted statute that may result in the government taking an innocent person's life, then there is no subject matter by which the legislature can exercise oversight. This may be the most quintessential and core function of the legislature. So I appreciate very much this hearing today. I think it is extremely appropriate that we're here.
The first witness that was called was former Palestine police officer Brian Wharton, who arrested Robertson, but now says they made a mistake.
I told my wife last week that I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed that I was so focused on finding an offender and convicting someone that I did not see Robert. I did not hear his voice. He's an innocent man, and we are very close to killing him for something he did not do.
Robert Dunham joins us now. He's the director of the Death Penalty Policy Project. And Robert, welcome back to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
So, Robert, what's your overall view about what is happening with Robert Robertson? There was an appeal that was filed yesterday again to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and then just this morning it was shot down on procedural grounds, according to what we're being told. It seems like the courts don't want to hear the evidence, that they're locked into all of this procedural stuff. You know, it's like, well, you didn't follow the rules. There's a right way and a wrong way to try to keep someone from being executed, and you're not doing it the right way. I mean, is that what's happening?
Well, that's what the courts seem to be saying. I think there's actually more to it than that. Courts have been looking for procedural ways of avoiding the merits in death penalty cases. Clearly what the Texas courts are doing is nothing like what the legislature intended. Texas has one of the best laws in the country, if you just look at the words of the statute, in terms of allowing people who were convicted based on false science or junk science to get a new day in court. And in cases where it's the most important, where literally getting it wrong is a matter of life or death, the Texas courts are finding ways of not reviewing the evidence at all. In most of the cases where junk science testimony has been challenged, the courts have been much more receptive. In one-third of the non-capital cases, the court has granted a new trial. It hasn't granted a new trial in any of the capital cases. And so in doing that, they found procedural reasons why it was deemed inappropriate for the defendant to raise the evidence at the time that he did. But in capital cases, the evidence doesn't come and expose itself on the schedule that the court would like. It exposes itself when the defense is able to discover the evidence. And that is rarely on a timeline that can avoid one of these procedural defaults that the state court has been using to throw death row prisoners out of court.
So that's what Representative Moody was talking about, saying that they passed a law. They thought it was a good law that would help keep innocent people from being executed in the state of Texas, but the courts are unwilling to use this law. It goes to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and they just ignore it. And he's wants to, this today's hearing is to try and find, what's the solution? What do they need to do to this law in order to make it work? And today it's not working. So that movie, so make play another soundbite. And this is again from the former police officer, Brian Wharton. He's now the Reverend Wharton. He's now a minister in Palestine, Texas. And this is what he says about the appeal process.
And to those who hold the power to do something here, now is the moment. There is literally a life hanging in the balance, and there is no time and no place for half measures. We constructed an appeals system because we understood that we get things wrong. We wrote laws to work within those appeal systems because we understand that we get things wrong. It's all pointless if nobody will admit we got it wrong. And so, please, whoever you may be, Bardens and Paroles, Governor's Office, don't make my mistake. Listen to Robert.
Robert Dunham, what's your reaction to what we just heard there from Brian Wharton, who said that this morning?
Reverend Wharton is absolutely right. And, you know, this is a pretty decently written law. And the law is pretty clear that if the evidence is flawed, and that without the flawed evidence, the jury would have found a defendant not guilty, then the conviction or death sentence should be overturned. But that's not the way the Texas courts have interpreted it. And a law, even one that is well-intended and in some cases even one that is well-written, is meaningless. It is worthless if the courts are not willing to enforce it. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has essentially judicially rewritten the statute so that it isn't this straightforward, the evidence is bad and it could have resulted in a bad conviction. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has interpreted it in a way that it will only grant relief if the person can show evidence that's strong enough to eliminate any rational basis for their conviction. So it doesn't look at whether the evidence was bad and that could have caused the conviction. It looks to see if there's any other way that it can uphold the conviction. That's just not what was intended. And in death penalty cases, that can be fatal.
And it means an innocent person like Robert Robertson, he appears to be, is due to be executed tomorrow. Today, it looks like they're moving him from Livingston to Huntsville to the Walls Unit and putting him in the cell, which is adjacent to the execution chamber. That is happening, and he will be put to death. And not because he did anything wrong, it's because of the way the Texas death penalty system is set up. Our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I mean, you can be in favor of the death penalty, but opposed to the way that Texas is doing it. And I think that's a reasonable view. And I would like to hear from folks what's their take on that. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we'll be back in a minute. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We have the latest developments in the Robert Robertson execution. It is pending. He is still set to be executed tomorrow at around 6 p.m. A new filing to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals asking the court to consider evidence that will prove that no crime ever occurred and that he is actually innocent. That was rejected on procedural grounds. Death Penalty Action, a death penalty abolition group, is delivering petitions with thousands of signatures to Governor Greg Abbott, asking him to halt the scheduled execution of Robert Robertson. Right now in Austin, the Texas legislature in the Committee on Jurisprudence is having a special hearing called to consider what went wrong with the Robert Roberson case, what's wrong with the Texas death penalty system. I don't think these people, the lawmakers, they may be outraged, but they have no power to actually stop Roberson's execution, but they could pass new laws in the upcoming legislature to try to prevent another one. We're now speaking with Robert Dunham. He is the director of the Death Penalty Policy Project. Robert, more broadly thinking, it does seem like we're seeing a lot more death penalty executions over the past couple of months. Is that just my imagination, or what's going on?
No, that is true. We've had more executions in a short period of time, and we haven't had this many executions in such a short period in 3 decades. Now, some of it is coincidental, because the fact of the matter is we're still going to have fewer than 30 executions this year. And if we went back more than a decade, it was always higher than that. This will be the 10th straight year with 30 or fewer executions. And even more importantly, the number of death sentences is way down. We'll have actually more executions this year than new death sentences, which indicates that as far as the public and juries are concerned, they don't want the death penalty. But there are some states that are trying to aggressively carry it out. And in fact, in the last decade, almost 90% of all the executions in the United States have come from just 6 states. So we are seeing what looks like an increase, but it is these habitual executing states that are responsible for it.
Like Texas.
Like Texas. Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Florida, Alabama, and Georgia.
Let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. If what's your take on the death penalty, the way Texas does it, and can it be improved? Should it be improved? Let's go to Bonnie. And Bonnie, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering why no one's brought up the, it was a Supreme Court case, I think it was Atkins versus Virginia, that where the Supreme Court ruled it was a violation, that it was cruel and unusual punishment to execute an intellectually disabled person.
All right, Bonnie, thank you for the call. But Robert Roberson is not intellectually disabled. He is clinically developmentally disabled, but that's, and his IQ, although while low, is not low enough to grant him protections. And your take on that, Robert Dunham?
Yeah, I think that's right. The protection from Atkins goes to individuals who are intellectually disabled. There are issues in the way Texas enforces that as well. But the way it plays into this case is that Mr. Robinson's autism was in some ways responsible for the way in which the hospital workers and the prosecutors regarded him. They thought he had reacted inappropriately to his daughter's death, and they used that as a way of focusing on him as a potential murderer. So it does play a role here, and it's another reason why it's so important that we take a look at what the actual physical evidence tells us here, because there are a lot of other factors that focused attention improperly on Robert Roberson as a possible murderer. The man is innocent. There was no crime. And because of his autism, he was focused on as a likely suspect.
I'm going to play another soundbite. This is from Robert Roberson. I went to Texas Death Row a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke to him for a while. And I did ask him about what he is thinking about his pending execution.
You know, we all one day is going to die in here, population out in the world. I'm a piece of God, if that's what you're talking about. I'm a piece of God, you know, because I know he has the last say and he knows what's best and stuff, you know. And it may be that may happen to protect me from some other pain later, I don't know. But I'm at peace if I have to go over there, you know. I don't want to go over there, don't get me wrong. Most people don't really want to die, you know, because I feel that God has more for me to do, you know, on this earth.
And so, Robert, Talk about this, the Texas Board of Pardons, and that they had to make a recommendation that Governor Abbott would, if they say they'd give no recommendation or they recommend no pardon for him or no clemency for him, then Abbott's hands are tied. He says, I can't do anything. But if they do recommend it, then he has the choice of whether or not to take up that recommendation, and he can provide clemency or a pardon. So is that how that works?
Yeah. Now, if they come up with no recommendation, he still has the power to grant a reprieve, which would give a little bit more time for other issues to work their way through the courts. But in terms of changing the death sentence or granting a pardon, he wouldn't be able to do that. The problem with the clemency process is that almost nobody ever gets clemency. And people who are innocent have been denied clemency and been executed. In Texas alone, the Death Penalty Information Center has identified 10 cases in which people were executed. They went through the clemency process and was turned down, despite very serious doubts as to their guilt. And there have been 18 other people who were exonerated from death row in Texas. There have been 200 exonerations nationwide and 1,600 executions. That's one exoneration for every eight executions that have taken place. But there are dozens of people who are actually innocent who have been executed. And there have been very, very few grants of clemency anywhere in the country. When we see them, it's typically like we saw in Illinois, when Governor Ryan commuted the entire death row. In Texas, it's been very rare. But then again,
well, let me just point out, though. Let me just say this: that in May, Texas Governor Abbott pardoned a man convicted of killing a Black Lives Matter protester. This guy was given a 25-year sentence. And was convicted in the courts, and Abbott pardoned him for that. So, but when it comes to Robert Roberson, we're not seeing any action.
Yeah, and that exposes the political nature and the practical problems with clemency. What one has to hope here is that Governor Abbott understands the strong evidence, not just of innocence, but the fact that there was no crime at all. And there are a number of cases in which people have gone to death row for the deaths of children that weren't crimes. It's time that the governor see this case and grant clemency. Robert Roberson should not be executed. He shouldn't be in prison. And if clemency is to mean anything, this is the kind of case where it needs to be granted.
So if Robert is put to death tomorrow, will this case be remembered as when Texas got it wrong and should be used to rectify, change things?
It should definitely be used to rectify and change things. But I think it just underscores that the death penalty process is flawed. Texas is extremely flawed, and I think even people who support the death penalty have to take a hard look and see, is this the kind of death penalty that we can support?
All right, Robert Dunham, he is the director of the Death Penalty Policy Project. Thank you for joining us. We're going to take a break here, and we'll come back and we'll do our pledge drive. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. How important is masculinity when it comes to politics, especially in this election? Republican nominee for President Donald Trump likes to present himself as a macho man. That might be hard to believe, but that's how many of his followers see him. They have fantasy posters of him ripped with muscles, looking like an action movie hero. And GOP vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance also promotes himself as hyper-masculine, to a point where some MAGA supporters carry around little jars of Vance's fake sperm. The GOP merchandises of a little plastic jar labeled with a photo of Vance's face, and it reads J.D. Vance Full Family Kit. This apparently is an attempted cheap shot at Governor Tim Walz, the Democratic vice presidential nominee. The inference is that Vance would be a better candidate, a better vice president, because he doesn't need IVF to sire children. This style of masculinity that Walz presents, though, could be seen as more accessible and inclusive and also more healthy. The former football coach was also the faculty advisor for his high school's Gay-Straight Alliance, thus proving that toughness and manliness doesn't have to be homophobic and toxic. And of course, the Democratic nominee for president, Kamala Harris, is a woman, and which might be triggering for many of these folks with macho issues. Dr. Ronald F. Levant joins us. He is a pioneer in the psychology of men and masculinity and the former president of the American Psychological Association. His new memoir is The Problem with Men. Dr. Levant, welcome to the Source.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, this is an important topic because it's one of these things, it's all around us all the time, but if you don't pause and start noticing, then it just sort of just whizzes past us. So how do you see, when you're looking at this election, are you seeing the masculinity card being played?
Very much so, but, you know, I think one of the ways to understand the current election is to dig a little deeper into this concept of the alpha male. You know, Trump presents himself as an alpha male. In fact, he's called himself that. And he says, you know, I never apologize. I never admit fault. But the alpha male was originally described by a primatologist who recently passed away, Francis Duval, who was actually considered the foremost primatologist. He studied chimpanzees. And he described two versions of the alpha male. One is called the dominant alpha, who essentially achieves his status as the alpha of the troop through bullying and violence. What happens to these types of alpha males is that a coalition of other males may eventually overthrow him and kick him out of the troop. The second type is what's called the populist alpha. And this is the alpha that cares for the troop, providing resources like food and shelter and caring for injured or sick members of the troop. And this particular alpha is loved, is said to be loved by the troop to the extent that we can understand how chimpanzees feel, right? So looking at the present election, the comparison is obvious. You know, Trump is the bully alpha, the dominant alpha. Both Walz and Harris, although Harris is obviously not a male, you know, represent that populist version. Walz, for example, in his, you know, care of his students, he was known to, you know, be very generous with his time. You know, with students who had trouble, he sponsored the GLBTQ Alliance. He had an initiative as governor to put feminine hygiene products in the schools and things of that nature. And obviously, if you look at the policy, the proposed policy of the Harris-Walz agenda, it includes a lot of things designed to help working families and individuals. So, you know, I think that kind of makes it clear. It also makes it clear as to why we have this gender divide where there's kind of a 10-point difference between the way the sexes kind of sort out in terms of their support either for Harris or Trump.
The thing about in a democracy, it's a numbers game. You want more people. There can only be one alpha male. And so if you're aiming to just go for the alpha male vote, I mean, how does that win elections?
This current election is razor thin in terms of, you know, whether you look at the polls, the differences between, you know, the two tickets are very small, and all the pundits who know more about this than I do say that it's going to come down to, a few thousands of votes in the swings, the seven swing states. So it is very close.
But it does seem, though, he is doing the Trump Vance ticket. When you look at how these polling numbers are broken down, that they're doing very well, particularly with young men. So that seems to be their message. And it does also look like that they're polishing their credentials of being an alpha male as by being hostile to women.
Right. And again, to clarify, they're essentially following the bully version of the alpha male, not the populist version. And probably the bully version is more well known. Right. Well, Vance sort of made his reputation as an alpha male through the kind of the down low route of essentially demonizing women with his infamous comment about, women who do not have children that they themselves birth, calling them childless cat ladies and insisting really that women's role is as a mother and a nurturer, attempting to turn back probably nearly 70 years of history in the United States since women were confined to that role. I have no idea how well this is going to go, but it is clear that the Trump-Vance campaign has lost most women. The question is whether, Harris and Waltz can make up their gains with men. And they're clearly trying. They're trying with white men without college degrees by going to rural areas. They're trying with black and Latinx men by, going to barbershops and appearing on, I forget the name of Univision, I think it's called the station, that is has a Latinx audience. So, but there are different appeals. And another kind of interesting question to figure out is kind of what would our country look like if either side won?
Right. So looking at, your research and your memoir, The Problem with Men, the idea, though, that these are different types of masculinity, and one would probably is more healthier than the other. One is not about being emotionally unavailable. It's about being emotionally available, being nurturing. That's a masculine model that I think was good for families, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's the model I and my colleagues tend to promote. We try to counteract a lot of this, socialization that goes back to early childhood for boys. When I was a boy, a long time ago, I knew that the worst thing I could do as a boy was walk, talk, act, or throw like a girl. I don't know, was that true for you when you were a boy?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And, okay, so that meant that we had to avoid things that girls do, some of which, are actually represent very helpful resources, like being emotionally self-aware and able to express how you feel. Men typically avoid that. I actually have a scientific-sounding name for that. I call it normative male alexithymia, and we can get into that if you want, but it simply means there are many men, and by the way, whenever I give an in-person lecture to a group, I always ask them, how many of you know a man who can't tell you what he feels? And everybody raises their hand. So I think it's fairly common. But this results from that boyhood socialization, that really begins with crying. And that begins very early, like elementary school or even preschool. You boys get told big boys don't cry, or they get threatened. If you don't stop crying, I'll give you something to cry about. Have you ever heard that in your life? I did. And so what happens when boys don't cry. Well, crying, you know, all humans have tear ducts, obviously. And crying is known to release certain hormones like oxytocin and endorphins that actually relieve feelings of sadness, you know, and make you feel better. So, you know, in this light, kind of prohibiting boys and males from crying can be seen as very cruel. I had one extreme example in my practice of a patient that I was seeing. When I asked him the last time he cried, it was 10 years ago when his dog was hit by a car and killed. Mm. Can you imagine not crying for 10 years?
Right. So we're going to take a break here. Just to, you know, we're talking about masculinity on the ballot, but this is a, you know, a high profile masculinity examples that we're seeing now in our society. And we're looking at two very distinct models. One is healthy, the other one not so much. We're going to talk more about that when we come back from the break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Is the country ready to elect a female president? Does Vice President Kamala Harris possess enough masculine traits for her personality to persuade those undecided, people who are soft on that issue? Like, can a woman be president? Can she persuade them? Why is that an issue at all? Well, it's not just her competence and her policies. Why do we even have to think about masculine issues? Why is Donald Trump, why does he put so much effort in trying to present himself as a masculine alpha male? We're joined by one of the leading experts on this issue, Dr. Ronald Levant, and he has written a new memoir, The Problem with Men. And so, Robert, why does Kamala Harris, does she come into this argument with a deficit because she is a woman?
Among some men, I think she does. But, you know, look around the world and many countries like United Kingdom, Germany, the European Union, you know, have women as premiers or leaders of one fashion or another. And the idea that women can't lead, is patently absurd. I'm not just talking about countries. Look at corporations, look at universities, look at kind of any institution, and you'll find female leaders. But, you know, as Obama pointed out, you know, in his recent speech, which was aimed at black men, you know, some people just don't feel it. And it could be based on, you know, their socialization as we were talking about earlier, you know, if they're male, they were socialized to view what girls do as inferior to what boys do. Okay. So it could stem from that. Obviously in an election, we don't have time to do psychotherapy on the electorate to help them get over that. We just simply have to persuade them that, a woman president would be actually good for them.
Yeah. John, I think his name is John Waters. He's on Fox and he was on the air and he said, "Real men don't vote Harris." And there was a lot of cackling about that, about how, you know, it'd be like real men don't eat quiche, something they used to say. Now real men don't vote Harris, like that. Somehow, if you did vote for her, that it would reduce your masculinity. Can you respond?
Sure. And he's playing a very dangerous card. He's trying to threaten men's sense of masculinity if they vote for Harris. Now, I've actually studied this phenomenon of threatened masculinity because I'm very concerned about violence, particularly gun violence, as a researcher. And in 2020, I can't believe that was 4 years ago, I published an article that looked at this discrepancy, the discrepancy being that well over 90% of the violent crimes committed in the United States are committed by men, for some, depends on the crime, some as high as 98%, okay? And you can get this at the on the FBI website for their crime statistics. Yet the vast majority of men are not violent. You know, we use our words to solve problems, to solve disagreements. So what accounts for this discrepancy? What differentiates a tiny minority of men who would commit, you know, even the most heinous acts of violence, that is mass shootings? And so I looked into the research, not only in psychology, because I wanted to get outside my silo, but also sociology, criminology, cultural anthropology, and social work. And I found across these various academic disciplines the same finding. Obviously, different methods used, different terminology, but the findings were that the men who are more likely to be violent are men who feel that their masculinity has been threatened. And let me put a cherry on top of that. There was recently a settlement regarding the Sandy Hook massacre with the gunmaker of the weapon used by the perpetrator, Remington Arms, and the settlement was for $73 million. How did the parents and survivors of Sandy Hook win that settlement? They won it based on the way Remington advertised their weapon, which was an AR-15. The advertisement had various forms, but basically it pictured the weapon running diagonally across the page. In the bottom right corner was the logo of the company, which happened to be a serpent. And then in the bottom left-hand corner was a caption. And the caption read, and this is the important point, "Your man card reissued." So essentially, the gun maker was advertising the weapon to certain types of men who feel their masculinity has been threatened, and getting them to see that buying this weapon would make them would restore their masculinity.
Well, so that's a cheap manipulation, appealing to a very basic, vulnerable part of men who have some sort of problem with their how they see themselves. And maybe the same thing is happening with these candidates as they make an appeal to them, saying, you know, vote, you know, who is the most macho, vote for that guy. Robert, thank you so much. Dr. Robert Levant, he is a former president of the American Psychological Association. His memoir is The Problem with Men. Thank you so much for coming on board today and talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to take a break here from The Source. And when we come back, we'll continue our pledge drive. Hope you stay with us.